This presentation on apologetics and worldview by Dr. Paul Hennebury of TELUS Theological Ministries is offered for the edification of all students of God's Word by spiritandtruth.org. It is our prayer that this presentation will deepen your understanding of the Bible, resulting in an improved ability to share your faith with others. Now let's begin our time with Dr. Hennebury.
One of the big things that the general run of scientists say when we complain about the fact that they employ naturalistic philosophies to science and to the way that they do science, which means that they will only look for explanations that can be within the natural world, yes? They cut off any supernatural explanations a priori before they even enter into the investigation. They say, we're not looking for supernatural explanations. We're not looking for intelligence. We're looking for purely natural explanations. One of the things that they do to exclude Christians and even exclude those who are non-Christians, but who come with another explanation of intelligent design or theism is that they say, well, if we do that, then the scientific explanation of creationists is that God did it. And that's all we'd have to say. You know, we wouldn't do science. And, of course, that is a caricature and a twisting corruption of the way that it really is. It's a lampooning of the Christian position. It's not at all true. It isn't a criticism that even many good atheists take seriously. The bad atheists, like the new atheists, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Victor Stenger, those kind of people, they will say that. You know, Eugenie Scott, these people, they will use those arguments. They're very bad arguments. And you will find that people who are exposed to those arguments use them. And I think it's important that Christians know how to respond to that. They implicitly kind of know that it's wrong, that just because we believe in God, just because we believe the world is created, that doesn't mean that we can't explore the world. It doesn't mean that we can't do science. In fact, of course, in the history of science, it is more and more being understood and proclaimed that modern science grew out of the cradle of Christianity, the medieval scholastics and the Reformation and so on. So that's a lie, but how do we respond to it? You know, straight away that kind of thing puts us on the back foot. You know, if we just allow creationism in, the answer to every question will be God did it. And the way that we respond to that is that we have to understand and be able to articulate what creation means and what a place in creation means. Creation, of course, is the act of a good God who places order in the world and places us in the world to understand that order and also to participate in creating new things within that order. He has given us a creative ability, and we're going to do a thought experiment in a minute, you know, to kind of bring that out a little bit more, so that we can work with God in the world, so that we can discover things that God has put into the world. That in that discovery of the things that God has put into the world, we learn, you know, the information has not just been input into our brains so that we don't need to learn anything. We keep learning as we explore the world and as we start to think about the world, reflect on it. And as we learn, we find out more about God's goodness, God's glory, and we give glory back to God for what he's done. But none of that means, just because we give glory back to God, none of that means that we don't do experiments, that we jig our experiments in a certain way, that we don't use a certain method of finding, accruing evidence and testing things and finding theorems and hypotheses and so on, testing those. Doesn't mean that at all. In fact, biblically, we need to understand that it is wrong for us just to say God did it. Okay? It is actually wrong for us to just say God did it, as if that is an answer. We know that God did it, but a scientific question will not, or answer is not God did it. Yes? And in fact, a worshipful answer is not God did it. The worshipful answer is, we know God did it, but how did God do it? Why even did God do it? Then we start entering into more about who God is, more about God's relationship to the world, more about what God put into the world for us to discover. Do you see? That's science. So actually it encourages science. Science, to do true science, you need to have a system of what? Ethics. Okay, so you're not doing what lots of scientists have been found out and students have been found out doing in the last few years, falsifying their data. Okay? So yes, you actually need morality. Some other things here. You have to have an environment that doesn't change. Why? You couldn't experiment if, yes, exactly. Yeah. You have to, if we say this involves intelligence and reason, let's throw into there the ability to intend to do something. To calculate, to use numbers and logic. To reflect and meditate. To build. To construct out there. Okay? There's a big difference between conceiving it here, putting it down on paper, and actually building it out there. To communicate, you need language. Yes? In fact, language is really key. Without language, you wouldn't be able to reason. Moral norms. You'd also have to have what's called a realist relation to the world. And all I mean by that is that you would have to believe that when you were looking at the world, I mean, you could have, as we've said before, you can have like things like mirages and so on. But generally speaking, your interaction with the world is interaction with the world as it really is. Okay? The brain is not reinterpreting things and presenting you with a different view of the world than is actually out there. Okay? But you're having direct contact with the world as it really is. Yes? Alright. So what kind of a world view might support that? Let's think of different worldviews that there are out there. And again, I've kind of already given you some of this, but give me a worldview. You're not allowed to give me the Christian one yet. So give me a worldview. Natural. Naturalism, because that's what we're going to be studying today. Naturalism. What does naturalism teach? Naturalism, materialism. What does that teach, basically? The what?
Everything comes from nature.
All there is matter in motion, okay? Matter and energy exchange all the time, okay? So in naturalism, the only components you have are matter and energy, or matter in motion, and the going through time, yes? Do you have, if it's all you have is matter and energy, do you have any purpose? No. So things are the way that they just turn out to be. They couldn't be any other way. Okay? I mean, going along that strain. It's just matter going the way that it's going. So in that sense, everything is utterly determined. Do you see? Right? If it started off and went in a different direction, it would have been probably different. But it would have been determined in a different direction. But still utterly deterministic. Alright? So, you have matter in motion and everything is utterly deterministic. All there is the material world. There's no mind, there's no purpose behind it, because all there is nature. So how do you get your creature from that? How do you get these things? How do you get emotion? How do you get consciousness? How do you get a conscience? How do you get the ability to reason and intend and point and so on? How do you get a body that is built so that you can actually interact with the world in a way that you can do science? Because we've got these things, okay, which really help us to interact with the world in the ways that other creatures can't. We have eyes in the front of our head like this. What's that?
Lots and lots of time and bacteria.
Time, bacteria, mutations. Yeah, but that's the answer, isn't it? Okay, that really is important that you see that. Is there? Can you think of anything else that might do it within that paradigm? Okay, so the fact that you end up with this stuff, okay, as well as the, by the way, all the multiplicity of other creatures, is down to what? Chance, isn't it? There's no purpose. It's down to chance. So that outlook, that worldview, which of course is evolutionary, yes, that worldview isn't going to fit our experience. Okay, it's not a good starting point or explanation point for all of the different things that the creature has. If you were a divine counsel, you wouldn't choose naturalism to get what you wanted. Okay? It's a dumb way. Why? Because there's no guarantee unless you guide it, but you're not allowed to guide it. And even if you guide it, it's still a hugely wasteful way of doing it. And as a good designer, what's one of the things that you want to cut down on? Waste. Yes? You want efficiency. You don't want to waste your time, waste the energy, waste your manpower, waste your materials. Create a mess that you've got to clear up, or someone else has got to clear up. What about another worldview? There's actually only a few, so.
It's not real.
That's right. Yeah, it's not real. Okay? But if it's not real, then how are you going to end up with this?
What's that called?
Okay. Well, that's the monism view. That's the idea of, Eastern religions or the New Age movement. It's pantheism or panentheism, actually. So with that view, okay, where everything really is one, it just appears to be different, okay? But the reality is not what we see. The reality is the oneness, okay? With that, well, you're trying to create a being that is creative and does science. But if you use that worldview, that creature wouldn't do science, would they? Because they wouldn't. They'd say, well, why experiment? Because if I'm experimenting on something that's different than me, I'm denying my worldview, which says that everything's one. There are no differences. Do you see? And remember, I said that when you see these Buddhist monks and they're coming around and they're begging, they're denying their worldview every time they do that. If everything is one, why are they going to other people to get food? That would mean that everything is not one, wouldn't it? And if everything is one and they're still going out to these different people and going to these different places, obviously they're not helping themselves, are they, towards the truth? They need to stop doing that so that they can merge to the one, because the amount of time spent doing that is the amount of time denying what they say is true. So anyway, that worldview is not going to work, is it? What's the only kind of worldview that's going to produce these beings who write stories, write poetry, write history, write science books, do experiments, pass down knowledge, and so on, think about things, talk about things, bounce ideas backwards and forwards, will have to be one where they believe that there's purpose in the world, that they can engage the world as it is, and that the world is worth engaging. Yes? That's what the Christian worldview does. That's why modern science was birthed by Christianity. Don't please believe the 19th century screeds by Draper and Andrew Dixon White and people like that, which talk about the history of the warfare between science and religion. There was no warfare. There was no warfare. That is a very modern thing, and the only reason that there's a warfare is because one side has redefined what science is, and that it's naturalistic. Do you see? And then there was a conflict. What about the Galileo affair? Galileo was supported by the Roman Catholic Church. He had a villa provided for him after the Inquisition by the Pope. He was not maltreated for anything apart from the fact he was a really obnoxious individual. Okay? But the Catholic Church had no real problem with his science. They supported it. I mean, anyone who knows anything about the Galileo affair knows that. Okay? Pope Urban, I think it was a personal friend. What about the Scopes trial? Well, we did that last time, you know? That was just a media fanfare event, you know, ACLU thing, which has been wrongly reported. So, Christianity, therefore, supports this. Now, modern science or modern atheistic views, because they're naturalistic and say that science must be naturalistic and we must view the world as just the product of nature and the laws of physics, they come up with all kinds of absurdities. Now, I've already alluded to this, you know, people that say that we are just machines, okay? Daniel Dennett, who's one of the four horsemen of the new apocalypse, you know, one of the new atheists, he's not as well known as Richard Dawkins, but he's written books like Darwin's Dangerous Idea, Consciousness Explained, where it doesn't explain it, and other books, Breaking the Spell. You'll find these if you go to Christian, if you go to bookstores or you go to, secondhand places. He says this was, quote, an impersonal, unreflective, robotic, mindless little scrap of molecular machinery is the ultimate basis of all the agency and hence meaning and hence consciousness in the universe. An impersonal, so no person, unreflective, no thought, robotic, mindless, no direction or pre-thought, little scrap of molecular machinery is the ultimate basis of all the agency, that is, anything that does anything, any function, and hence meaning, and hence consciousness, even consciousness, in the universe. Well, you're conscious, you think you have meaning, but you're connected to this mindless, blind scrap of machinery. And that's all that you are. You're just a more advanced robot. He really believes that. He really does. Well, he says he does. I mean, he teaches it to his university students. As many people in our universities are taught it. As many people in psychology classes, even sometimes in Christian colleges, are taught this. If that's the case, I hope that you can see that's not much of an explanation for the fullness of life. But it is what they believe. And it is basically what these popular science presenters, Bill Nye, the science guy, you know, and what's his name? Neil Tyson, the Nova presenter, the guy who did Cosmos, you know, Carl Sagan before him, but the new Cosmos. Neil deGrasse Tyson, his name is, yeah. He believes that. Well, says he believes it. I mean, he says, we are space dust. That's one of the quotes from that thing. We are merely space dust. Space dust doesn't think. Space dust just aggregates and gets in clumps. Yeah? And by the way, it doesn't really do that very well. So, we have a basis in creation. If we understand what God is telling us here and what we believe, we have a basis for doing science. If you believe that we're a robot, if you believe that there's no purpose, remember, no meaning. Meaning comes from this robotic scrap of machinery. So meaning is really invented by us. If you believe that, then I hope that you would see that you have no basis for doing science, writing poetry, doing anything. But we do, don't we? We do. And we're talking particularly about science here, and I hope you can see that Christianity, the Judeo-Christian worldview, is perfect for science. Yes? Why on earth would you want to switch a worldview that encourages science, that gives you all kinds of hope of doing science, that gives you in the Noahic covenant, I'm not going to bring a flood upon the earth again, but while summer and winter continue, yes, seed time and harvest continue, remember Genesis 8:22, things will remain the same. The uniformity of nature is guaranteed by the Noahic covenant. So we've got the uniformity of nature that we need for science. We've got faculties that we can trust. We've got even a mandate from our creator who's made the world out there to do it, to go and explore it. Why would you exchange that worldview? And by the way, all the ethical mores that you need in order to do honest science and all of those other things. Why would you exchange it for one of these other worldviews? That's exactly right. That's exactly right. In fact, what you'll find again and again and again is that even though these other approaches to life don't make sense of our experience, which is what I've been teaching you, they are adopted. Why are they adopted? Because people don't want to face the God with whom we have to do. And remember Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1 says that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven toward all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress, hold down, imprison the truth in unrighteousness. And it says that they become futile in their thoughts. Their worldviews, okay, become futile. Now look how this works. So Christianity, okay, or the we'll just say the Bible, as the Word of God, the Word of the Creator, gives you all of what you need to do science, yes? The other worldviews don't. Naturalism certainly doesn't. Naturalism doesn't encourage science at all. This one does. So, if that's the case, and this even goes to the emotional aspect of men as well, why is it rejected? It's rejected, so we can take this off and we can put just atheistic naturalism or materialism. Okay? All there is matter in motion. It's replaced so that people don't have to face up with their creator. But here's the problem. When you replace something that does explain our abilities to do science, and our abilities to do anything else, by the way, with something that doesn't explain, that can't explain it, you get absurdities. You get futilities. You get questions that are asked which receive no answers. And so what do you do with questions that are asked that can't receive answers from these other worldviews? Like, you know, is there any purpose in life? Is there any purpose to my life? What am I here for? Why is the universe here? These are big questions. Where am I going? Okay. Well, usually, those things are swept under the carpet. Usually, those are not questions that can be asked. They're non-questions. You know? Don't bring those up. And we're just dealing with applying this to what we can do and not asking how come somebody who's utterly determined and can't think other than the way that they think, which is determined by the laws of nature, how come I love certain people? How come I have a call for justice? How come I can do science? How come I can write poetry? How come I can do all of these things? Do you see? And the response usually is, well, either don't ask that question, or that's not what we're talking about right now, or it has to do with that, well, actually, You just think you can do those things. But you're not. You're just a robot. So the fact that they substitute these other worldviews in place of the worldview that makes sense of our experience shows the sinfulness and depravity of man. It is a proof of the truth of the Christian claim that people don't actually believe it. Because one of the central truths of the Christian claim is that we are rebels toward God. We're sinners. We want to go away from God. We want to be independent of God. You can't be independent of God if you embrace the view that God is our creator and we're answerable to him. Okay, so let's move on a bit from that. And I took a little bit longer because we've got a couple of new people here, so I took a little bit longer than I would have done otherwise.
Isn't that a bit of self-stultification on their part? Why would this man be teaching in a university if it's just random firing of neurons and there's no purpose in him doing that? It's really not reality.
You're right. You're right, but you're not supposed to ask that question. That's what I just said. You're not supposed to ask that question. Because we're doing it. Do you see? If you ask those kinds of questions, you very quickly become a pariah in modern education. Very quickly. You're supposed to just sign up to the prevailing worldview. All knowing, whether it's knowing how to cook, whether it's knowing how to get home or drive a car in order to get home or learning a particular subject or do science, all has this from to integration to find out things. Now, this is very important for a number of reasons. But because we're talking about science particularly here, I want you to note this reason, that scientific knowledge is not any different than any other sphere of knowledge. Okay? It's not different. This idea, and so I'm going to shove this on there because I want to wear it. So this idea, I want to wear that, but I'm not going to. Of the clinician or the scientist in his white coat. See, as soon as I put the white coat on, right, I look more impressive. I mean, I look as though I know what I'm talking about. Everything I say is true. Now, you know, especially if I put this on, now I really know what I'm talking about. You see? Automatically, there's this mystique that arises because of what this signifies in our culture. All right?
It's the loafers that tie it all together.
Thank you. So, we get this idea that scientists are these kind of detached, dispassionate, wholly objective individuals. And they portray that themselves. Nothing could be further than the truth. They're just as passionate, and in fact even more so, than you and I. Because many of them are trying to get funding. Many of them are trying to get up in the ranks of scientists and get published, get noticed, get university appointments, keep university appointments, get tenure, get published and all of this sort of stuff, yes? Get a name for themselves so they can speak at conferences. Maybe have their own TV special. They're just the same as you and I. They are just as committed to a worldview as you and I. And most modern science is naturalistic. So they have to be what? Committed to purely natural explanations of the phenomena that they explore. Do you see that? They are not neutral. They are not dispassionate. No knowledge is dispassionate like that. Okay? Because you don't find out stuff that way. In fact, you know that intuitively. In fact, you also know that you don't keep knowledge by being that way. You have to go back and what? Enter into it again, don't you? You learned this, you went on, did something else. Oh, I've done that, but now I have to go back and relearn. And as you relearn, what do? You have to do this from to stuff, okay? You don't just dive back in with complete recollection of what you did. If you haven't played piano for years, you have to go back and start off ping pong, you know. You may be reasonable, but you know you've got a lot of catching up to do, and you've got to focus. The same with scientific experiments, the same thing. Which means that there's no such thing as this coolly objective scientist. In fact, this idea of just objectivity in knowledge is a lie. It's always subjective and objective. Now, there is objective truth, but in order for you to know it properly and fully, and not exhaustively, but as much as you can, you have to subjectively commit to it, passionately move towards it. So that's what Polanyi's view of knowledge was, and it really accords with our experience, and it accords with the Christian worldview also. It also gives the lie to this mystique of the scientist. You know, science is speaking, everybody else shut up. No. You can tell me, if you're a scientist, you can tell me about your particular speciality in science, okay? But if you start telling me about philosophical issues, if you start telling me that science has to just use naturalistic presuppositions, I don't have to listen to you to 5 seconds, because you don't know what you're talking about. Whether you're wearing a white coat or not. And don't you trust anyone who has that view, okay? Or trust scientists who come out with that bluster. It's rubbish. Utter rubbish. And I'm going to start to prove it here. So, Philip Johnson, some of you know about Philip Johnson. He wrote the book Darwin on Trial. Some of you may know that started the intelligent design movement. This is, I think, the second book, Objection Sustained. This is some letters that he wrote and so on, some essays. It's a very good book. And I don't have... he was a Berkeley law professor, by the way. I'm not going to go into his stuff, but I am going to read from an essay where he quotes one of the leading evolutionists and biologists of the last kind of 50 years, Harvard professor Richard Lewontin, about his view of science and why they do science, okay? And some of you may even have known this quote because it's a famous quote. It was in the New York Review of Books some years ago. Lewontin said this: "We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories. Because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. Does he sound objective to you? It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation for the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations. No matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated, moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. And Johnson's says here, that paragraph is the most insightful statement of what is at issue in the creation-evolution controversy that I have ever read from a senior figure in the scientific establishment. It explains neatly how the theory of evolution can seem so certain to scientific insiders and college professors and teachers, and so shaky to outsiders. For scientific materialists, the materialism comes first. The science comes thereafter. We might therefore more accurately term them materialists employing science. You see that? It's just a fact, folks. It's just a fact that modern science, Bill Nye the Science Guy, Neil Tyson, Stephen Jay Gould, Carl Sagan, any of these guys that you might find, David Attenborough and so on, they all hold to this view of scientific materialism or naturalism. The people that write the textbooks, Douglas Futuyama, who I quoted last week from his book, his textbook on evolution, okay? They all hold to this view. Folks, they are not neutral. They are not dispassionate observers seeking after the truth. They are seeking anything, any explanation, apart from God. That's what evolution is. That's what naturalism is. That's why these scientists will point to intelligent design theorists and creationists who have got PhDs from, you know, very well accredited schools, the same schools that they've got their PhDs from, and say, they're not scientists. They're not doing science. Do you remember what I told you about Thomas Kuhn? I said that Thomas Kuhn, he wrote this book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and in that book, he said that scientists, you know, they enter into a culture, and they enter into the study of certain programs, and they accept certain assumptions and presuppositions, and they all work within that community, okay? And the things that they work on, the things that they test, the things that they allow as assumptions, as scientific and not scientific, are all governed by that culture. And then, as that culture is sticking to a particular outlook, let's say the Newtonian view of gravity and the world and so on, the universe, and all these questions keep coming up, all these anomalies start coming up as they're doing their experiments and thinking about things and thinking, well, that doesn't really work there, but let's not just ignore that, okay? We'll find out about it down the road. And eventually, all these questions become more and more weighty as more evidence accrues to contradict the reigning, what he calls the reigning paradigm in science. And then someone comes up with, and usually they've done it before, but they come up with another explanation that better fits these facts and answers all of these anomalies, like Einsteinian relativity. And then there's a paradigm shift, and everybody jumps onto that ship. And then the textbooks are rewritten. Do you see? So that the history of science seems to be this nice, you know, progress towards knowledge, when as a matter of fact, it's this. You see? At the moment, evolution and naturalism is the reigning paradigm. And so what happens is that those in that paradigm, those who are committed to that, they will only admit into science and into their journals and into their universities and so on, those that hold that view. Everybody, anyone that questions that and says, hold on a minute, the emperor doesn't have any clothes, is not a scientist. Because we're the scientists, and this is what scientists do. You see? And evolution, as we will see, and we'll see a little bit more next week, evolution has all of these problems that are starting to look, make it look really bad. The more we investigate the universe and see the fine-tuning of the universe, the more that we investigate the cell, the more we understand information because of computer technology and so on, the more we understand what information is, the less likely it looks that evolution through natural selection and mutation can actually explain these things. Sooner or later, there will be a paradigm shift, folks. Even evolutionists themselves, they're keeping quiet. I mean, they'll never say this on TV programs. They'll never say it outside of, you know, the certain closed doors. But even evolutionists themselves are starting to give up on neo-Darwinism because they think this doesn't work. This doesn't explain. This mechanism cannot produce this stuff. Do you see? And so there's going to be a paradigm shift. Now, if you want my guess as what that paradigm shift will be, I don't know when it will be. I think it will be in the next 25 years. But I think it will be this cosmic design. I think it will be this view, what's called panpsychism, the view that the universe is sentient. The universe is our designer. Okay, might be aliens, but that the search for alien intelligence isn't going very well. So I think it will be this mysticism that comes in, that there is a design, there is a designer, but it's not going to be God. Okay, it's going to be a God that's not going to judge us, but is going to be responsible for the order and the intricacy in the world. Yes, so things will start to go mystical. Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, become more New Agey and stuff like that. Yes, and in fact, you might think that's strange, but you know there are top philosophers who are writing this way already. Richard Tarnas, who wrote The Passion of the Western Mind, and he's written his follow-up book was Cosmos and Psyche, which is this view that the cosmos has this kind of psychic reality to it. Yes, yes, quantum spirituality. You even have some of these guys, Rupert Sheldrake in England and his people, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, he's a great scientist, and but people think he's a bit loopy because he thinks the sun is a person. Okay, but that's the way it's going to go, because sooner or later they're going to have to explain somebody designed this stuff. Did any of you actually do what I asked you to do last week and look up the kinesin? Did you do it? Did you see the film of this thing? Basically, it has feet, and it drags parts of the cell along from one part to another part of the cell. It's not looks living, doesn't it? I mean, it's not living in a sense, but I mean, it certainly looks designed. How do you explain things like that from mere matter of motion? It starts to become ludicrous to do that. So that's what's going to happen. Okay. Also, if you look at Polanyi's work here, okay, this view of knowledge as personal, not impersonal. OK, Can you see the theistic implications of it? Because knowledge, knowing things, is personal knowledge, and that's what his magnum opus is called, personal knowledge. The world is personal in a sense. And in order to know it, you have to enter into and have some kind of commitment to it. And as it rises, as things have more personality, you find out more about it, okay? So it has this theistic implications because it dovetails with the Christian worldview, but doesn't dovetail with the naturalistic worldview at all. So, I gave you Luontin's quote, and I want you to see now how an agnostic, this is David Berlinski, he's a mathematician and scientist, his book, The Devil's Delusion, Atheism and Its Scientific Pretensions, is a great book. And let's see how he responds to the Luontin quote, okay? He's kind of one of these guys that couldn't care less about being part of the scientific establishment. He critiques it, he lampoons it. But they have to take him seriously because of his credentials and because they can't say, well, you're a creationist, because he doesn't believe in God. He's agnostic. I mean, he's a proper agnostic. He just thinks atheism's stupid too. So he's talking about that Luontin quote. And he said this. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs. The geneticist Richard Luontin remarked equably in the New York Review of Books, quote, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories. I've just read this, yes? End quote. Why should any discerning man, Berlinski asked, or woman, take the side of science or anything else under these circumstances? It is because, Luontin explains, we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Berlinski goes on, if one is obliged to accept absurdities for fear of a divine foot, imagine the prodigies of effort would be required were the rest of the divine torso found wedged at the door and with some justifiable irritation demanding to be let in. You see, they cannot allow, this is this point, they cannot allow any kind of hint of theism. So they cannot allow Polanyi's philosophy of science, even though he's a world-class, nearly a Nobel laureate. His son was a Nobel laureate. This guy worked with Einstein. They cannot allow that view because it has these theistic implications. They can't allow intelligent design. This guy is part of the intelligent design community, even though he critiques it somewhat. But he's agnostic, you see. But they can't have ID taught in schools because theistic implications of a designer. They certainly can't have creationism taught in our public schools because, well, that's just religion. Okay? And he's critiquing that. On page 60 and 61 of this book, he writes this. Is there a God who has, among other things, created the universe? Quote, it is not by its conclusions, C.F. von Weizsäcker has written in The Relevance of Science, but by its methodological starting point that modern science excludes direct creation. Our methodology would not be honest if this fact were denied. Such is the faith in the science of our time and which we all share. See, what Weizsäcker is saying there in that quotation is the same of what Luontin said. Okay? We have rigged the methodology of science so that the only people who can be called scientists are the ones who are naturalists or believe in naturalism. Now, there are some exceptions. Ian Hutchison, who's a professor of nuclear physics at MIT, is a Christian. I think he's theistic evolutionist, unfortunately, but he is a Christian.
John Lennox.
John Lennox at Oxford University, a mathematician, yes. Henry Schaefer at Georgia Institute of Technology, again, is a Christian. But they're few and far between, and they're kind of embarrassments. They don't get on the TV programs. Now, Berlinski just quips here, in science, as in so many other areas of life, faith is its own reward. And then on page 50, talking about naturalism, he says, neither the premises nor the conclusions of any scientific theory mention the existence of God. I have checked this carefully. The theories are by themselves unrevealing. If science is to champion atheism, the requisite demonstration must appeal to something in the sciences that is not quite a matter of what they say, what they imply, or what they reveal. In other words, the question of God is completely outside the realm of science. You can't rig science to exclude God. You shouldn't even be thinking about whether, you know, as far as you doing your scientific experiment or defining what science is, you shouldn't even be thinking in a sense that shuts God out. That makes no difference to what you're doing. But that's what you're told. That's what they're taught at university. You've got to have this view of methodological naturalism. And he goes on to say, everything, the philosopher Alexander Byrne has remarked, is a natural phenomenon. End quote. Quite so. But each of those natural phenomena is, Byrne believes, simply, quote, an aspect of the universe revealed by the natural sciences, end quote. If what is natural has been defined in terms of what the natural sciences reveal, no progress in thought has been recorded. If not, what reason is there to conclude that everything is an aspect of the universe revealed by the natural sciences? There is no reason at all. There is absolutely no reason for bringing naturalism into science. It doesn't belong there. Science should be what? The search for truth in the natural world. If it was brought about by aliens, it was brought about by aliens. If it was brought about by natural causes, it was brought about by natural causes. If it was brought about by the God of the Bible, then it was brought about by the God of the Bible. The science doesn't change. But you have to have a world view that makes sense of you doing the science in the first place. Remember the transcendental argument? You're having the preconditions for what you're doing. Okay? You've got to have a world view that makes sense of these things. Later on, he talks about, on page 95, Oxford's Peter Atkins has attempted to address an issue. If we are to be honest, he argues, then we have to accept that science will be able to claim complete success only if it achieves what many might think impossible, accounting for the emergence of everything from absolutely nothing. And then Berlinski says, Atkins does not seem to recognize that when the human mind encounters the thesis that something has emerged from nothing, it is not encountering a question to which any coherent answer exists. His confidence that a scientific answer must nonetheless be forthcoming needs to be assessed in other terms, possibly those involving clinical self-delusion. Science says these things, but it has no right to say it. In fact, science doesn't say it. Scientists stepping outside of science in their lab coats or in their, you know, with their jargon and so on, say these things and they don't know what they're talking about. the philosopher. this is Thomas Nagel. That's his book, Mind and Cosmos. Now, Nagel is an atheist philosopher. Subtitle, Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. This has just been released, well, a few years ago. Storm of protests against Nagel for even writing this book. Okay? He's not a theist, so they can't call him a creationist. He writes this on page 41. Here he's talking about consciousness, although you said conscience, but I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt anyway. He's talking about human consciousness, okay? A voluminous and intricate literature has grown up around these problems, but it serves mainly to confirm how intractable they are. The multiple dead ends in the forward march of materialism or naturalism suggest that the mind-body dualism introduced at the birth of modern science may be harder to get out of than many people have imagined. It has even led some philosophers to eliminative materialism. I'll explain that. I've already talked about it. The suggestion that mental events, your consciousness, thoughts and so on, like ghosts and Santa Claus, don't exist at all. That's Daniel Dennett, who I quoted. That's the Churchlands at San Diego University. That's Peter Singer, the most influential ethicist in the world at Princeton. You don't really have mental events. You don't have consciousness. But Nagel continues, but if we don't regard that as an option and still want to pursue a unified world picture, and I think we do, I believe we will have to leave materialism behind, or naturalism, that the fact that all there is nature or the material world. Conscious subjects and their mental lives are inescapable components of reality, not describable by the physical sciences. You can see why he has brought down a lot of annoyance on himself. Here's Anthony Flew. Anthony Flew was the foremost atheistic philosopher in the world for many years. Wrote the Atheist Dictionary and so on. What's this book called? Why There Is a God? Oh, sorry, There Is a God, yes? There Is a God. It's written by Anthony Flew at the end of his life. And, of course, there was a storm of protest that this world-class atheist philosopher should all of a sudden believe in God. But this is his testimony of why he started to believe in God. And he says in the book, he says, look, the facts haven't changed, but my realization of where they pointed changed. He says here, and I'll just read you a little bit. You might ask how I, a philosopher, could speak to issues treated by scientists. The best way to answer this is with another question. Are we engaging in science or philosophy here? When you study the interaction of two physical bodies, for instance, two subatomic particles, you are engaged in science. When you ask how it is that those subatomic particles or anything physical could exist and why, you are engaged in philosophy, not science. When you draw philosophical conclusions from scientific data, then you are thinking as a philosopher, not a scientist.
That's what PhD is.
Yes. And he says this on page 41. He says, a person can be persuaded by an abominable argument and remain unconvinced by one that ought to be accepted. Why? Well, I've tried to explain to you why, at least in the realm of science. If you have cordoned off by your definition what science is and is not, by a philosophy, not by science, the science doesn't require it, but you've introduced a philosophical metaphysic called naturalism. All that there is the natural world, matter in motion. If you've done that, that's a really abominable argument. And as with our thought experiment, remember, naturalism doesn't provide you with all of the things that you need to be a creative and scientific person, and yet they hold to it. You can hold to a bad argument and be completely unconvinced by one that you ought to accept. In this class, what is the one you ought to accept? Sorry? Biblical Christianity, the biblical worldview. I've been teaching here in these classes that unless you accept the biblical worldview, you are not... You cannot make sense of anything. And you say, well, lots of people make sense of stuff without accepting the biblical worldview. Not within their worldview, they don't. The only way that they make sense of the world is by doing what? Stealing from the biblical worldview. That's right. Stealing from the biblical worldview. And then claiming that they are, you know, working within their own worldview. C.S. Lewis, I know that we've got a few more minutes here, so please hang on. I've got to get through this material. Just hang on for a little while longer. I think that you'll find it helpful. I've got C.S. Lewis here, so he's usually interesting, is he not? So in his book, Miracles... he says on page 21, and we're talking about naturalism here. And he says this, a theory which explained everything else in the whole universe, but which made it impossible to believe that our thinking was valid, would be utterly out of court. Now, what did Daniel Dennett say? Daniel Dennett said, remember, that we are... we come from impersonal, robotic specks of machinery. Purposeless, mindless. Yes? He believes that your mind, your consciousness, in fact, he doesn't believe you have consciousness. It's just a trick played on you by your neurons. You think that you are a person. You think that you are an individual. You think that you have chosen to believe these things that you believe. You think that you've chosen the life that you've chosen. But you haven't. It's just your DNA driving you. So that's utterly deterministic. It's the laws of physics. That's all it is. And Lewis is saying here that such a theory would make it impossible to believe that our thinking was valid. For that theory would itself have been reached by thinking. And if thinking is not valid, that theory would, of course, be itself demolished. It would have destroyed its own credentials. It would be an argument which proved that no argument was sound. A proof that there are no such things as proofs is nonsense. Thus, a strict materialism refutes itself for the reason given long ago by Professor Haldane, quote, if my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true. And hence I have no reason for supposing my brain to be composed of atoms. In his God in the Dock, Lewis also tackles this, and He has this to say. Again, just stick with me here just for a little bit, if you can. I'll start from the beginning of the paragraph. On the fully naturalistic view, all events are determined by laws. Right? Laws of physics, laws of chemistry, and so on. These are what? Impersonal laws, aren't they? Our logical behavior, in other words, our thoughts, and our ethical behavior, including our ideals, as well as our acts of will, are governed by biochemical laws. These, in turn, by physical laws, which are themselves actuarial statements about the lawless movements of matter. These units never intended to produce the regular universe we see. That is, there was no purpose. The law of averages has produced it out of the collision of these random variations in movement. The physical universe never intended to produce organisms. The relevant chemicals on Earth and the sun's heat, thus just opposed, gave rise to this disquieting disease of matter, organization. Natural selection, operating on the minute differences between one organism and another, blundered into that sort of phosphorescence or mirage which we call consciousness. And that, in some cortexes beneath some skulls at certain moments still in obedience to physical laws, but to physical laws now filtered through laws of a more complicated kind, takes the form we call thought. Such, for instance, is the origin of this paper. Such was the origin of Professor Price's paper. That's this professor, this naturalist that he's writing against. What we should speak of as his thoughts were merely the last link of a causal chain in which all the previous links were irrational. He spoke as he did because the matter of his brain was behaving in a certain way, and the whole history of the universe up to that moment had forced it to behave that way. What we called his thought was essentially a phenomenon of the same sort as his other secretions. The form which the vast irrational process of nature was bound to take at a particular point of space and time. When Professor Price defended scientists, speaking of their devotion to truth and their constant following of the best light they knew, it seemed to him that he was choosing an attitude in obedience to an ideal. He did not feel that he was merely suffering a reaction determined by ultimately amoral and irrational sources, and no more capable of rightness or wrongness than a hiccup or a sneeze. Do you get what Lewis is saying there? You cannot hold to naturalism as a worldview and take it seriously and believe that your thoughts about the world, okay, and your experiences about the world are real. And yet, Daniel Dennett and the Churchlands and so on, they know which car to go to. They know who their friends are. They know who each other are, yes. They even bother writing books. But according to what Lewis has said here, and he's quite right, the only reason the Churchlands write books about the fact that everything is predetermined by their neurons is that their neurons have predetermined them to write the books. If the neurons have predetermined them to write the books, as the neurons in Shakespeare's brain predetermined that he would write those plays, do you see there's no truth claim in anything? It's just what the machinery is producing. And our recognition of it as a Shakespeare play or some really boring, psychological nonsense from the Churchlands is just, again, a function of the way that we, our DNA and our synapses are snapping at that particular time. Our faith commitment, our belief in God, our belief in atheism, our belief that we're people and not Napoleon, maybe, that we're ourselves and not Jesus Christ. All of these things, just the firing of our neurons. Folks, you see how futile this belief is. And yet, this is the reigning paradigm in our universities, in our schools, on our TV programs. Finally, then, tonight, Alvin Plantinga, in this book, Where the Conflict Really Lies, he's a top-class philosopher, actually influenced Nagel. He is a Christian. He has come up with what's called the evolutionary argument against naturalism. In other words, he's turning naturalism and the theory of evolution against himself. And he's going to do it in the same way that Lewis basically does it in that essay. But I'm not going to give you, he takes about 50 pages to do it here. So I'm not going to go through Plantinga. But I'll go through what another philosopher, James Spiegel, does in this little book. And give you it very briefly, and then we'll close after maybe one or two questions. So Spiegel begins by saying this. On the biblical view of atheism, the biblical view of atheism, rejection of God deadens the mind when it comes to theological and moral truths. Atheists are cognitively handicapped and their quest for understanding is compromised. You might even say that regarding certain issues, they are genuinely desensitized to truth, such that they cannot perceive it even when they encounter it. Remember what Flew said? People accept abominable arguments when they should accept good ones. Perhaps this is why atheists are unable or unwilling to perceive how their view actually undermines rationality itself. Alvin Plantinga has developed an ingenious argument showing why belief in naturalism can never be reasonable. These guys are always saying they're rational. They're always saying that they're, you know, they're the paragons of reason. And you people who believe in God, you faith people, you know, you're irrational. Yes? We believe, it's like believing in Tooth Fairy or the Flying Spaghetti Monster. Here is a rough gloss of his argument. He begins by noting that the naturalist must embrace Darwinism. And in our thought experiment, what did you come up with as an apparatus to produce the different things that are needed for a creative and scientific mind? You came up with something that started to sound like evolution, didn't you? Do you remember that? Yes? That was about an hour ago. All right. This is because in ruling out the supernatural, there are no alternatives to explain living organisms. For the naturalist, Darwinism is the only game in town. Now, if the Darwinist story is correct, then everything about us formed through natural selection. Every trait of every living thing is the result of the survival of the fittest. Characteristics are preserved only if they provide a distinct competitive advantage in the struggle to reach reproductive maturity. And although genetic mutations give rise to various novel traits from time to time in evolutionary history, fitness is the sole determinant as to which, if any, of these genes are perpetuated in the gene pool. Now, here is where things get interesting. Given Darwinism, even our cognitive faculties must be the result of natural selection. Every aspect of human brain physiology and psychology was entirely fixed by its survival value. This means that nowhere along the human evolutionary path did a concern for truth necessarily come into play. so long as an organism's cognitive apparatus, its thoughts, enables it to stay alive, its beliefs need not be true or even reasonable. There is no necessary connection between the survival potential of a cognitive system and the truth of the beliefs it produces. Does that sound implausible? Well, consider an example. Geocentrism, the belief that the Earth is at the center of the solar system, was a very practical belief for centuries, providing all sorts of benefits to sailors, farmers, and others who subscribed to the view. Yet, as we know, this view was false. Geocentrism was quite practical, though it was not true. So you can have a belief that's not true, do you see? But if it enables you to get by, that's all that evolution cares about, yes? That's his example. Consider this more fanciful example. Suppose I form a belief that the federal government will arrest anyone who has credit card debt and put them into prison. Consequently, I destroy my credit cards and pay off the remaining balances and live a much more financially responsible life. Not only do I not have to worry about being apprehended by federal agents, but I also am able to pay off other debts and even accelerate my mortgage payments. My false belief about the federal debtor's prison thus benefits me and my family, yet the belief is false. What these examples show is that the practicality of a belief does not imply its truth, nor does the practicality of an entire cognitive system guarantee that it is aimed at forming true beliefs. This means that if naturalism is true, then we have no reason to be confident that any of our beliefs are actually true. And this includes our belief in the truth of naturalism. In other words, if naturalism is true, then we have no reason to believe it is true. If ever there was a self-defeating worldview, this is it. Do you see that? So, don't fall for what the world tells you when it says science has only got to do with investigating nature, and all there is nature, and we cannot allow God into it because of this God did it answer. No. You may have to correct their apprehensions. We don't say just God did it. That's not a statement that means anything. Okay? We want to know why God did it, how God did it. Those are scientific questions. And moreover, God's not going to tell us. God's given us faculties. God's given us a world to explore so that and encouraged us to go and do science and do experiments and do thought experiments and use logic and number and stuff to find out. Moreover, there's this theory of knowing, which is not this just cold, dispassionate view of the so-called modern scientist, but rather it's this view that we come to knowledge by collecting skills, by focusing on little areas of things, getting to know that, making that part of our skill set and finding out more. We enter into knowledge of God's creation more and more. Your naturalism can't, not only does it exclude God from science, but naturalism itself science can't be done under a naturalistic paradigm. The great Nobel laureates who were atheists, Steven Weinberg and, these guys, the famous Richard Dawkins and these scientists that we read about, Stephen Jay Gould and Carl Sagan and the rest of them, they're naturalists, but they couldn't do their science if they really held to their naturalism. Because their naturalism gives them no reason to believe that their beliefs in naturalism are true. Their worldview collapses in on itself. How come they can do science? You answer. How come they can do science? How come we can send, and we'll do this a little bit next week, how come we can send these probes out to, you know, the gas giants and out to Pluto and so on, take photographs of it and send them back? How come we can do that? Because these atheists, these naturalists, are stealing from another worldview. Numbers are not material things, but they need numbers to do their calculations. They need to believe that the universe is basically going to be the same tomorrow and also in years and years' time, so that they can get to Pluto and take their photographs, as it is today. They need to believe in uniformity. They need to believe that their beliefs are true and that they're not just the creation of neurons firing in their brains. The Christian worldview, which supports creative process and the engineering process and the scientific process, that's the basis, that's the worldview in which science can be done. It's the only worldview in which science can be done, folks. So when people do science and do these things and they don't give God thanks for it, Romans 1 says they are condemned.